We're spending the hour on pocketbook issues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers struggle to make inroads on that new coronavirus relief package. The $600 per week unemployment boost, that is gone. Republicans proposed last week to extend the enhanced benefits, but at $200 per week in unemployment income through September. Democrats want to extend the $600 weekly checks until at least the end of the year. So how is your financial position? Have you been laid off or furloughed, or are you preparing for that day to come? What questions do you have about cash flow? Are you investing now or putting money into an emergency fund? We're at 800-642-1234 for all your money questions. Aaron Lowry is a personal finance expert, author of Broke Millennial, Stop Scraping By and Get Your Financial Plan Life Together. Aaron, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Wonderful to be back.
Well, the last time you were here, we were talking about investing, but this was pre-COVID. Is putting your money into a 401k still a good retirement plan in the world we're living in?
I completely empathize and understand why a lot of Americans at this moment feel like, hey, I need to press pause. I can't afford to right now. Or it could even be something like your employer stopped matching, and now you're wondering, what do I do? Yes is the simple, short answer. But as always, with all things money, it can be a bit more nuanced. And ultimately, the answer is it depends. But yes, continuing to contribute to your 401k or your IRA is still a good idea, even as the market, you know, as it does, can sometimes rock and roll a little bit. You do need to keep steady and keep contributing.
Well, we have seen many employers suspend their matching programs, and I'm wondering what your reaction should be if you are in that situation, if you are an employee whose match is gone. What should be your next move?
So if you're an employee whose match is gone, one of the things that you can consider is just keeping on with your regular contributions that you've been doing, continuing to put money into that plan, if that's just what's simplest and what is most comfortable. The other thing that you can consider is if you feel that your 401k plan, for whatever reason, doesn't have the creme de la creme of investment options, or maybe the expense ratio and the fees feels a little bit high, but it was always worth it because of that employer match, and now that's no longer there, you could look into opening up an IRA or a Roth IRA for yourself instead in the interim, and be contributing money towards that IRA and being able to have a bit more flexibility in the investments you pick, perhaps lower expense ratios, which means you're saving money in fees over the long run. And the reason that that could work out for some people instead is you're still putting money away for retirement. You're possibly taking advantage of that tax break now, or if it's a Roth, you're taking advantage of that tax in the future. And you're, again, this idea of you still need to be putting money away for future you. You still need to be taking advantage of those magnificent things of compound interest plus time, which particularly for the millennial generation, even Gen Xers, we still have quite a bit of time until retirement, and we really don't want to be pressing pause.
On those IRAs, there are the traditional IRAs and there are the Roth IRAs. Can you remind us the difference and maybe some decisions we would make in choosing a Roth?
So the difference really just comes down to the tax advantage. Both are tax advantaged accounts. Both are retirement accounts. But with the traditional IRA, the advantage is today. You're getting that tax break now. If you put $6,000 into your IRA this year, you're lowering your taxable income by $6,000. Now, the Roth IRA, you're getting that tax break in the future. So you are putting the money in post-tax, so you've already paid taxes on it. And then in retirement, when you take the money out, you don't have to pay taxes on it. So really, the calculation that you're running is, are you in a lower tax bracket today? If so, hey, let's go with the Roth. Let's go ahead and pay that tax rate now. And then in the future, I'll be in a higher tax bracket, but I get to take that money out tax-free. Ultimately, I always say it doesn't really matter in the sense of, hey, you are investing for retirement. That is great. That is the ultimate goal. As opposed to trying to do the calculation and playing the odds of where you might be in the future. But generally, you hear the advice, if you're younger, odds are you're in a lower tax bracket right now, go with the Roth.
We're discussing pocketbook issues this hour with Aaron Lowry, the author of Broke Millennial, Stop Scraping By and Get Your Financial Life Together. You can join in with your money questions. What are your tips and tricks for investing? What has worked for your family over the years? How is your financial position changing during the pandemic? And what is your reaction? How are you changing your budget? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron, you know, we've talked about the importance of setting financial goals. How do you determine which goals are realistic right now?
Right now, I would say the number one goal that we all need to be focused on is shoring up that emergency savings fund. Even if you're in a job that you feel actually has some stability right now, it still is important to make sure that you have that safety net for yourself. So if you don't have an emergency fund, which is true for millions and millions of Americans, or if maybe your emergency fund took a hit or is continuing to take one, putting a little bit of money, or a lot if you can afford it, into that emergency fund every month is important. The other thing too is just looking at how to prioritize and perhaps reprioritize your goals based on what's realistic for you right now, what your household income looks like, what kind of the picture of our future, as much as we possibly can predict, which I know is incredibly hard right now, is looking like, and trying to really do kind of the true realistic approach as opposed to maybe the rose-colored glasses approach on the family finances.
So what would be that realistic approach? How much should we be setting aside in this emergency fund? You know, how do you divide it up?
The emergency fund really needs to have, and this is going to feel like a high number for a lot of folks, 3 to 6 months of living expenses. Now, what I always like to reposition is two things. First of all, that is your bare bones living expenses number. It's not the number of the lifestyle that perhaps you typically live or your aspirational lifestyle. It's the amount that you need to put food on the table, utilities paid, pay the rent or mortgage, cover your transportation costs, pay for any healthcare and medicine needs that you have that are monthly. And that's the number. So that doing that math, running out that list of, hey, these are all those things, tabulating it, adding it all up and looking and saying, okay, let's say every month $3,000 is your number. That's how much you need to meet all of your basic needs. Start with a month. Make that your first goal. My first goal is a bare minimum 1 month emergency savings goal. Then start to build on top of that. Once you hit that month, great. You've got a little level of stability now. Now let's push for two. Then let's push for three. Because thinking like, oh, I need $9,000, that can be a very overwhelming number when you first hear it. So starting with little bits. Sometimes you hear that idea of have $1,000 in your emergency savings fund. That's kind of a good stepping stone. Whether or not you have debt, you really need to have at least 1 month, because $1,000 might not get you very far in the case of a true emergency like massive job loss that we're experiencing right now.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, that emergency fund right now, so important. Where do you keep your emergency fund? And what type of account, Aaron?
That's a great question. You should not be investing your emergency savings fund. It should be a what we call liquid asset. It needs to be in a savings account, preferably a high yield savings account, which I know for some listeners, that's kind of a laughable term because they've seen moments where maybe high yield meant like 5 or 6% on your savings. Right now, 1% is considered good. But hey, that's better than 0.01%. So I do encourage you to actually shop around, look at the different options between your credit unions and your banks to see where you can get higher interest on your savings.
Aaron Lowry is the author of Broke Millennial and a personal finance expert. What questions do you have about investing or retirement? What would help your financial planning decisions now? Are you thinking about pulling some of your retirement money out early? What questions do you have about making such a move? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Aaron Lowry here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're spending the hour on money issues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. congressional Democrats and the Trump administration are deadlocked over negotiations for a broader coronavirus aid package that's expected to include some continuation of federal unemployment benefits. But until Congress hammers out a deal for more pandemic relief, families edge closer to devastating financial situations and decisions. What financial challenges is your family facing? Have you been laid off or furloughed? Are you struggling to keep up with bills? What do you want to know about investing, credit cards, savings, or philanthropy at this time? It's 800-642-1234. Personal finance author Erin Lowry is our guide. So, Erin, as you juggle bills, and if you have been furloughed or laid off, how should you deal with your credit cards if you're running balances?
Well, the first thing that you should do is run what I call the bare essentials budget. So you write out exactly how much you need to just hit your bare essentials needs in a month. And that, as we talked about just a little bit earlier, includes things like food on the table, utilities paid, rent and mortgage, transportation, which some of us are stuck at home still. So that's not quite as important, but you still want to make sure you have your car. And then also medicine or any healthcare needs. So first focus on that number and seeing if it's at all possible to hit those bare minimums. Then when it comes to your credit cards, it's also looking at the minimums due that you have every month. And if you can pay at least the bare minimum, that keeps you in good standing and it will help protect your credit through this. But if you look at all of that information, you're like, this isn't going to happen, which is, again, true for millions of Americans right now. The first thing that I always say is this is a situation where you want to ask for permission, not forgiveness. That old adage of it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission, not true when we're talking about lenders. You want to be proactive before you miss a bill, call them up and have a conversation and see what they can do for you. You know, we are experiencing a global pandemic. Within this country, we are seeing mass unemployment. Lenders understand and know this. So calling up and seeing if they can work out some sort of payment plan, if there can be a grace period that gets extended, anything that they can do for you. But it's best to do it proactively because that gives you a little bit more of the ball being in your court, a little bit more control.
How do you evaluate whether someone has the right credit cards? Or let's say you are deciding, like, maybe I can consolidate my cards and into a lower interest rate. Is that something you would think about right now?
That is certainly an option. There's a couple of ways you could go about that. First, when it comes to do I have the right credit card, I would say things to consider are you paying an annual fee? And if you are, is that still necessary to be paying? Or do we want to, let's say there's a balance on that card, roll that balance over to either a personal loan or balance transfer to a new card and close that annual fee down to save yourself maybe $95, $100, $150 a year. Every little bit counts right now. But the other thing, too, is just looking at how steep some of the interest rates are on these cards. Honestly, they're usually within the 20s, and that's a lot. So one of the things you can look into is called a balance transfer, where, and this sounds trippy, that you take out a new credit card to move your debt over, but that's what happens. You take out a credit card from, let's say it's with credit card A, has your debt. You open a new one with bank B, and you move the debt over. You usually have to pay a little bit of a fee, often around 3%, but usually that fee more than pays for itself with the fact that you can move over to 0% interest rate. So every little bit that you are putting towards that debt right now is going towards that principal balance, which is awesome. But if you don't want to tussle with more credit cards, that doesn't sound appetizing, you're afraid you're just going to get yourself into more credit card debt, and it's important to be honest with yourself here, you could also look into taking out a personal loan and consolidating that way. So you use the personal loan to pay off the balances on the credit cards, and then you start focusing on paying off the personal loan. And that's also an option to consolidate several credit cards if you want to streamline onto just one payment.
If you would get rejected when applying for a new credit card, what might be the reason?
Well, there's a variety of reasons. It could be if you've applied for several credit cards all recently and that to them looks like you're kind of trying to make a credit grab. It could be that you have a low credit score, which could have happened because perhaps you missed a payment, as many people are right now during the pandemic. It could be because you had a medical bill that went to collections that you didn't even know about, which is true for so many people every single year, regardless of a pandemic. And one of the things that you can do is First, you should pull copies of your credit report from each of the three credit bureaus, which are Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax. And you can do this for free. Under federal law, you are entitled to a free copy of your credit report once per year. So you can go to annualcreditreport.com. You don't ever get asked to put in credit card information. This is truly a free resource. And you can pull copies of your credit report. That doesn't have your score on it. It's just the report that tabulates all the information. So you can also see if maybe something is inaccurate, something got reported wrong, and then you can dispute that if that's the case. If you're like, there's no reason for my credit score to be low, that's another thing to be checking out.
We are discussing pocketbook issues this hour with Aaron Lowry, talking about credit cards, investments. We'll talk about donating, other issues around money. You can join in with your questions. How have you approached credit cards during the pandemic? How do you feel about investing in Wall Street amid the pandemic? Have you made any adjustments to your stock portfolio? What changes do you think are wise at this moment? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Aaron, how concerned should we be about our credit score right now if our financial life is spiraling with job loss? How long does it take to rebuild credit?
It can take years in some cases, but really the thing you have to remember with credit is it's great to protect it if you can, which means making at least the minimum payments due on your debts, working out grace periods or forbearance or deferment on loans with lenders, having those conversations proactively. But it is repairable, and that is an incredibly important thing to remember. And both as time passes, things kind of get weighted less and less. They are considered less important if you are pumping positive information onto your credit report. So as soon as you start to make all your bill payments on time every single month and not using too much of the credit limit on your credit card, that's a big one, because there are five factors that make up your credit score, but 65% are weighted by just two factors, which is on-time payment history and how much utilization of your credit card you use, which is a fancy way of saying if you have $1,000 in your credit limit and you're using $200 a month, that's 20% utilization. And they want to see no more than 30% of your credit limit used every single month. Even if you can pay it off in full every month, even if you max it out and can pay it off in full, they still want to see you not using all of it. So it's important to remember those two things if it's possible for you to do, but the on-time payment is a biggie. Missing a payment one time can be what really crushes your credit score. So trying to protect that as much as you can. And if you think you can't pay, like I mentioned earlier, be proactive and have a call and see what they can do.
Well, let's take a call now. Katie is joining us from Whitehall this morning. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
So,
yeah.
So last year, my husband and I knew we were going to have, or we were going to try to have a baby. So we started to max out our health savings account through his, works insurance, and, had our baby last year, or our babies. And we've continued to keep, funding that, like, at the full amount. And wondering if that's something that we should keep doing. I think he at work had gotten some advice from a financial planner to just fund that as much as you can since it rolls over from year to year, but we're just not sure if we should keep doing that or try to get that money out and put it somewhere else.
Katie, how often do you use the HSA? How often do you use it for medical expenses?
Well, we now have four children and the two of us, so we use it fairly often, you know, for emergency cases and stuff. Actually, we still have the hospital pulling from what we owe from our delivery straight from it, which is kind of nice. I don't have to deal with it. It just pulls straight from the HSA account.
Aaron, what would you suggest on the HSA account?
Well, first of all, congratulations. And honestly, I would keep doing what you're doing. HSAs are almost magical vehicles, in my opinion, when it comes to being able to invest and save for your future and having another tax-advantaged account along with perhaps retirement accounts. And especially the reason being, HSAs, the health savings account, are different than the flexible savings account, because with the flexible savings account, at the end of the year, it's kind of a use it or lose it policy, but that HSA, it keeps rolling and rolling and rolling. So you can be preparing for, you know, all four children throughout their lives as you're, you know, taking care of them until until they're no longer your dependents legally, and then, or I should say in terms of aging out, and then it can even be for your retirement. You can be all the way projecting towards potential medical expenses in the future. So I would keep funding it as long as everything else is still, you know, in terms of short-term goals, you have that also emergency savings fund. You are also putting money away into retirement accounts. So as long as you can still do those other things in tandem, you're in great shape to be putting money continuously into your HSA.
Does that HSA build interest at all?
You should be, you can actually invest within your HSA. That's one of the magical things about it. Depending on your state, it can be considered a triple tax advantaged account, and you can actually be investing the money that's in your HSA. So not only is it just gaining regular interest, it's growing at an even better rate, just like your retirement account.
We're tackling money and investing this hour with personal finance author Erin Lowry as our guide. Are you a financial planner? What are you telling your clients now, especially if they're newly unemployed? How often do you tell them to check their retirement portfolio? And what problems do you often see families making in a money crisis? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Erin Lowry, maybe hear from you right after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're tackling personal finance issues in the midst of the greatest health and economic crises in generations. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Even before COVID caused stay-at-home orders and massive layoffs, household debt had topped $14 trillion in the first quarter of this year. That's according to the New York Fed's quarterly household credit and debt report. What questions do you have about credit card debt, student loans, mortgage, or rent? What do you want to know about choosing an IRA or making decisions about retirement? What would help your financial planning now? It's 800-642-1234 to bring on your situation. Erin Lowry is our guide. She's a personal finance author of Broke Millennial. Erin, we heard from Mike in Stoughton, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Mike says that as people are heading back to work, some Wisconsinites still have not had their unemployment insurance applications processed and as a result have not received any unemployment payments. And Mike says, I don't know how people can make it financially when this is happening. What would you suggest if you're in that limbo?
It's such an incredibly complicated question and situation because there's no easy solution other than to keep pushing and keep applying until it gets processed and until you can get your money. And to have those upfront conversations with all the people who you would need to be paying, whether that's a landlord, banks with your mortgages, other lenders, and being honest and open about the situation as opposed to just delaying, delaying, delaying. And perhaps you can also work out an agreement on just a scheduled, you know, back payment plan if necessary as you finally start to get your money. The other thing too that I always recommend is reach out to your local community. The thing with this, especially the pandemic combined with the economic crisis, I completely understand and empathize why there's a lot of pride and perhaps shame and guilt that gets wrapped up into this, but we are genuinely in this together. And please be open, honest, and reach out to your communities, to your neighbors, to organizations that can assist you in a time like this and help you with your short-term needs while you start to get back on your feet.
As you explore the topic of donating, you've offered some advice to people considering whether to save their money or to donate it to the causes that they believe in. How do you suggest approaching the decision of philanthropy right now?
It's a great question. And the first thing, this question started to get asked when the first round of stimulus checks came in, because especially people who were in a situation where maybe they had not lost their jobs, had not been furloughed, and were meeting all their basic needs, felt like this is money that needs to go back into my community or towards a charitable organization, which is a wonderful instinct. But first, I always say, make sure that your own financial oxygen mask is on. And I don't say that flippantly, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't support your community. We'll get to other ways to do that. I'm saying that because just like when you look at on the airplane, parents are supposed to put it on before assisting children. You have to make sure that you're secure so that the problem doesn't reverse. And one of the ways to do that is coming back to the idea of the emergency savings fund. If you don't have an emergency savings fund in place, or perhaps it's not as strong as you would like it to be, that's where you want to keep focusing on building up in a time of crisis. And then the other things that you can consider is your time and your skills in lieu of cash. If cash is not really an option to donate right now, do you have skills, do you have time that can be helpful for charitable organizations, either nationally or within your direct community? And some of that is, you know, boots on the ground, helping with putting together food bags, making deliveries, or it could also be maybe you're a graphic designer and they need an updated website, or maybe you have social media skills and they need help getting the word out about their services. The other idea, too, is asking for donations in lieu of gifts. If you have a birthday coming up, or when we think about the holiday season, asking for the loved ones who would normally give you a gift, or even people who would normally go to a bar and buy a beer, buy a cocktail to celebrate your birthday, asking them, even if it's $5, to contribute that to a charitable organization. And perhaps even doubling that amount of money by seeking out donation matches. See if your employer, if you still have one, is offering those donation matches. Many around the country are. Or you can also, and this kind of sounds silly, but just keeping an eye out on social media, celebrities and major public figures have been matching donations to a certain amount, and seeing if maybe you can get somebody to match yours if they're announcing that they're doing that right now.
Have you seen any apps out there or ways to make it easier to be able to get people to donate to a cause, as you've said, you know, if it is a birthday or something like that? Is it more streamlined to make donations on behalf of someone?
Well, sometimes you'll see on social media, especially Facebook, you often see that that's an option for people. And I think it'll even give you a nudge around your birthday to say, hey, you can create a fundraiser if you'd like. And so that's certainly one. Or it's just as simple as you decide what the charitable organization you want to donate to is, and you share that link with your loved ones so that they can easily donate as well.
You know, you mentioned time and skills, and there are probably people out there with time and valuable skills. And in donating your skills at this time, could that open like a new network to you, maybe even a new career path?
It certainly can. And that is another reason, not only because it's the right thing to do to donate and lend our time and skills, but yeah, the networking opportunity. And even if it's not directly networking into the charitable organization, but just expanding your portfolio for potential and future employers about what you can do, that's a good idea.
We are diving into investments, credit cards, donations, other pocketbook decisions with personal finance author Erin Lowry as our guide. Still time for your money situation. What are you trying to tackle right now during COVID? Are you new to investing? What do you want to know? What questions do you have about stocks and trading, fees, advisors, other parts of the investment process? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Erin, you've written about the need for children to talk with their parents about money before emergencies happen. Why is this conversation important?
This conversation is critical because, and this might sound like a flippant way to say it, but are you your parents' retirement plan? And I truly don't mean that flippantly. I mean that your parents often sacrifice so much, including their own finances, when it comes to securing a stronger and better future for you, perhaps stronger and better than they had. But you also need to know, are you going to need to financially support them in the future? And a lot of parents, well, one, may not know yet, and two, may not want to be engaging in that conversation with you. It could be that it's a pain point for them. It could be a little bit of a pride thing, but it truly does reverse the roles of parent-child if you come to your parents and ask if you need to be supporting them. So you have to be incredibly tactful about how you go about this conversation. And also, for some people, this is a cultural thing, and of course you're going to take care of your parents. That's not even a question. But that's not always the case, not always the assumption. So you need to know, for your own financial planning, for your own purposes, whether or not you need to accommodate your parents and their care as they age.
What can happen if someone starts having lapses in memory and the family hasn't set up a financial plan for their care?
This is so critical that you need to make sure the legal documents are in place well before that happens, especially if you have a history of Alzheimer's or dementia in your family. You want to make sure that you have the healthcare proxy, the advance directive set up, and you want to make sure that you also have power of attorney set up. Now, a will is also important, but frankly, not as important as the other two. Because with the experts I interviewed for my book, one made the astute point of the will is for when the person has already passed. The other two are for when you're still alive. And that's critical. And the reason you also want to make sure you handle them early is because as soon as your loved ones start showing signs of dementia, it's possible that it's too late for them to actually legally sign these documents because they may no longer be of sound mind in terms of a legal definition to sign these documents. So have this conversation early, be proactive about it. And the other reason it's critical is because you need to be able to make potentially medical decisions for your loved one, especially if they are incapacitated and able to do so themselves. And the other option too is, let's say that your mom gets sick, ends up in the hospital, and her mortgage needs to get paid, and it's not on auto pay. And you can't just go to her bank and say, hey, I need to pay her mortgage without having the power of attorney. The first question they're going to ask you is, do you have power of attorney? Can you legally get access to her finances? So these are all important documents that need to get handled early, and they need to be open communication about them. Going in with a scare tactics aren't always the best way to go about it, but it could be helpful to say, you know, hey, mom and dad, 2/3 of people usually find themselves in a bind, usually find themselves either on disability or in need of disability at some point in their lives. So let's have a conversation about what would happen if that were to happen to you.
Well, let's take another call now. Albert is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Albert.
Hi. Great show. Couple of questions. Number one is, how does one go about finding a financial advisor to help you with these things? And how do they charge you? How do they figure out what you got to pay to get this financial advice?
Great questions, Albert. Can you help us understand financial advisors and how to find one?
Absolutely. And Albert, that second question is one of my favorites because finding someone and understanding how they charge you is a critical part of this process. First, the thing that you really need to know for everyone is that unfortunately the term financial advisor is not very strictly regulated. A lot of people can call themselves financial advisors. So you want to make sure you actually understand their credentials before you give them access to your money. And one of the things that you can look for is something called a CFP, a Certified Financial Planner. This is really the gold standard when it comes to financial planning because they have to go through a certain amount of education and they also have to adhere to a certain ethical standard in order to be considered and recognized as a CFP. So one of the things to also know is this person a fiduciary or do they adhere to what's called the suitability standard? A fiduciary simply means they are ethically obligated to act in your best interest. With suitability, they just have to make sure that their decisions don't harm you, which is a significant difference between those terms.
So, well, let's pause there with those two terms. Personal finance expert Aaron Lowry stays with us. Still time to talk about your financial situation. What are your tips and tricks for investing? How did you find your financial advisor? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Aaron Lowry on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with personal finance expert and author Aaron Lowry. We've been talking about the financial challenges, pandemic, economics, serious illness, job loss, how to help your neighbor at this time of distress. Aaron, let's go back to certified financial planners. You were telling us the distinction between fiduciary and suitability.
Absolutely. So with fiduciary, that is somebody who is ethically bound to be acting in your best interest, doing what is in the best interest of you and your money, where suitability standard is basically they just can't harm you. And it might sound a bit similar on the face, but really there is a big difference between the two. So when it comes to searching for a financial advisor, my recommendation is always to work with a fiduciary, preferably to work with somebody who is also a certified financial planner. Now, when it comes to finding these folks, there's actually a lot of options for online aggregators to find people that you can either talk to digitally or talk to even perhaps in your own neighborhood or at least city or town. You can go to sites like the CFP Board has a Let's Make a Plan is their website where there's a search tool you can use. There's the XY Planning Network and the Garrett Planning Network are three tools that I always recommend people use for when they're searching for a CFP. And I know the other question was about fees. How much do they charge? It does depend. A lot of CFPs are looking for more of that ongoing relationship with you in order to really do the best work in helping you. But some do offer those one-off plans. If you just kind of are looking for a tune-up, want confirmation you're on the right track, or maybe a big life event is coming up like retirement or getting married or having a child. And you can look at the fee-only structure makes it the most simple. You're just paying a fee for their services. But there are other options where, especially with non-CFPs, with other financial advisors, that could be commission-based. And if they are commission-based or if they're making money in commissions in any way, you just want to be crystal clear about how that works and making sure that the products that are going into your portfolio and the insurances they might be selling you are actually the best for you and not just what puts the most money in their pocket.
Well, Aaron, let's squeeze in one more question here. John in Madison called, couldn't stay with us, but says he has a small IRA, wants to pull it out. Will the CARES Act save him on early withdrawal since he is 53 years old? There's a 10% penalty, John says, if you withdraw early.
There is a 10% penalty if you withdraw early before 59 and a half is generally the rule on being able to take distributions. And I'm going to be honest, I don't want to give you wrong information. I would actually double check with somebody who has, you know, either that CFP cert or somebody who is much more nuanced in all of the lengthy fine print of the CARES Act before you make that move, because not only are you paying the 10% penalty, you will also have to pay taxes. So it could be a big chunk of change. There are kind of loopholes for what you're using the money for. So I would just make triple sure before you take any distributions that you check all of the boxes to make sure that you're not being double taxed with that, both that penalty and with then having to pay your regular taxes on top of your distribution.
So beyond 59 and a half, are there any other age milestones in taking a distribution from an IRA?
So from an IRA, I'm going to be honest, like this is not actually, I don't want to give wrong information.
Sure.
I'm very nervous about, because everything changed so much in the past couple of weeks. And I would say 59 and a half is the biggie in terms of being able to take your distributions without your big penalty. But I would certainly refer to either an accountant who would know in terms of taxation what your rules are. And again, CFPs, especially if you're approaching retirement, what makes me nervous about the idea of pulling money out at 53 is you could have a long, long life yet to live. And you want to make sure that you are not rating too much from future you and, you know, minimizing the impact that compound interest and time can have on building that future you. But if today's you really desperately needs access to that money, it's definitely a conversation that you want to have with a professional who can holistically look at all of the information for you.
Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me back. This has been great.
Aaron Lowry is a personal finance expert and author. Her next book is scheduled for release in December. It's called Broke Millennial Talks Money, Scripts, Stories, and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversations. And join us again next Wednesday morning at 6 for another hour about personal finance issues with UW-Madison Associate Professor Cliff Robb. He'll be here. His research explores financial decision-making and consumer behavior. That's next Wednesday at 6. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to a listener's question about a neighboring state.
One of the most popular questions we've received from listeners through the Wisconsin Project relates to our neighbors in Michigan. Many of you have wondered, what's the deal with the Upper Peninsula? Why is it a part of Michigan and not Wisconsin? We sent Laura Pavin to the UP last football season to find out more.
Think about it. Wisconsin, it shares more than 200 miles of border with the UP. Michigan's upper peninsula is connected to its lower peninsula by a bridge. And yet, the UP's part of Michigan. But why? Well, it was never Wisconsin's for the taking. In the late 18th century, Michigan and Ohio got in a tiff over a small piece of land called the Toledo Strip. They fought over it until Congress stepped in and proposed a compromise. The territory of Michigan could become a state if it gave the strip of land to the state of Ohio. In return, Michigan would get all of the Upper Peninsula. Eventually, Michigan took the deal. Wisconsin had only just become a territory at this point. So, here's an interesting thought experiment. Should the UP have gone to Wisconsin? Would it have made more sense geographically and culturally? To find the answer, I drove to the UP border towns of Marinette, Wisconsin, and Menominee, Michigan, and hung out with people at the bars during a football game. Because if you want to see where people's allegiances lie, you might as well take a look at what team they root for. And, drumroll please, the team of choice for Menominee residents I talked with was...
Packers.
Packers fan?
More of a Packer fan.
I hate the Lions. Hey, can I say that? I hate the Lions.
But why the Packers? Well, Green Bay's close to the UP. Plus, Packers games are broadcast on local TV. Beyond football, Wisconsinites and Upers also seem to share a bit of an accent.
Yeah, hey, don't you know? You betcha.
We say, oh. Oh, some people say we sound like Canadians.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Linguistics experts say that Wisconsin and the UP definitely share key features, like the long O, saying dem, dare, and doze. And some Upers and Wisconsinites share this thing called Canadian raising, which is basically where you say things like a boot instead of about. So, 2 points for Wisconsin, 0 for Michigan. Finally, there seems to be a deeper tension between the UP and their southern counterpart. Here's Kylie Sundstrom. She's lived in Menominee her whole life.
I think we just need to be separated. People all leave like the UP off of things, like maps and stuff.
More than a decade ago, a tourism commercial sponsored by the state of Michigan left the UP off, showed only the mitten. It actually led to legislation requiring that any official state publication show the state of Michigan in its entirety. So, Upers feel like they're left out of stuff. Some actually tried to make the UP its own state. All of this made me ponder. Do you need to be physically connected by more than just a bridge to feel like you're truly part of the same state? I asked Mary Antoine, a historian with the Prairie du Chien Historical Society.
In Wisconsin itself, there is an east-west. Living here in the southwest corner of Wisconsin, we feel that the whole eastern side of the state doesn't even know that we exist. That Wisconsin economy is totally focused on the greater Madison area and the Lake Michigan area from Chicago to Green Bay.
Culturally and geographically, Wisconsin and the UP look like they belong together. But continuous landmass or not, it seems like distance itself is the great divide here. That's something every state has to grapple with, including Wisconsin.
WPR producer Laura Pavin brought us that story. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.